You're listening to Classical 95.9, WCRI Block Island, Exeter, the classical station.
Welcome to Classical 95.9 WCRI's Conducting Conversations with your host, Mike Maino. 1 hour of music and conversation with notable people in the arts, bringing you the stories of how music has impacted their lives. The show will give a behind-the-scenes look at the guest's background, interests, or special project. And now here's your host, Mike Maino.
Conducting Conversations is brought to you by Roberts Musical Instruments, from sheet music and brand name instruments to rentals, repairs, lessons, and more. Roberts Musical Instruments is your key to musical success. Call 823-5459. That's 823-5459. And by Dr. Michael Sulo Art, regarded as one of the finest living portrait artists in the United States. Visit his gallery at the Velvet Mills Complex in historic Stonington, Connecticut. Call 860-334-1264. That's 860-334-1264. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Conducting Conversations. Tonight, we have a very interesting and different kind of show in mind. Normally, in the past, on Conducting Conversations, we've had orchestra leaders, we've had pianists, flautists, cello players, we've had everything you can think of in the world of music, and occasionally we stray a little bit to one time. For example, we had Valerie Tutson, the storyteller, and didn't play a lot of music with Valerie. And tonight is going to be kind of on that vein. We're going to play some music, but you'll probably never guess why we're going to play the music. I won't keep you in suspense any longer. I'll tell you that our guest name is Dr. Tim Warren. And if that doesn't ring a bell with you, maybe Dr. Tim will, as the fact that he's been in the news. He has a book out, and it's about climbing Mount Everest. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Mike, for having me. I appreciate it.
Great to have you here with us. We look forward to, at least I look forward at this point, to finding out a lot of things I didn't know about doing something like climbing the tallest peak in the world and all the things that are involved with that. And tell us a little bit about your background. I know that you're a lifelong Rhode Islander, as I am. Tell us where that all started.
Well, where it all started, I grew up in Richmond, Rhode Island. I went to Richmond Elementary School, Cherahoe, class of 1978. Immediately upon graduating high school, I stuck my thumb out and went to California with my good friend on the cross-country team, Dr. Dave Brown. And we spent 6 weeks on the road, hitching across the country.
He was a doctor right out of high school?
Amazing, isn't it?
That's a pretty good deal.
a little part of that story was that he and I both ended up sleeping in a cornfield in Davenport, Iowa on that trip, neither realizing that years later, both of us would end up in graduate school in that same town off of Route 80 in Davenport, Iowa.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's a great story.
A side story.
So yeah. You made your way to California, and yeah. And then what led from there?
Well, we launched into summer jobs and then onto undergraduate, and we went our separate ways, and we still see each other occasionally. But he went to URI, I went to RIC. And we were both always interested in health and wellness. And so we both ended up becoming chiropractors. Dr. Dave is down in Charlestown, Rhode Island, and I'm up in Warwick, Rhode Island. And I have been for 25 years now.
Now, Dr. Tim was the first man to climb Mount Everest, first Rhode Islander, I should say. Not the first man, the first Rhode Islander to climb Mount Everest. And you've written a book about it. What led you to mountain climbing?
My parents were and are quite adventurous people. They live in Virginia right now. And my dad was a teacher at South Kingstown and North Kingstown High School, and later he built houses. My mom was a part-time nurse at South County Hospital. And every time we had a holiday, vacation, we would get in the pickup truck and we would go to New Hampshire or Maine and we would camp and hike. And it wasn't really technical climbing like I would learn to do later, but I really got a love of the outdoors. That was a strong influence for me. Another strong influence for me was being inspired in 1972 watching Frank Shorter win the Olympic marathon in Munich, Germany, and which started the whole running boom in the country. Mm-hmm. And I was going from 6th to 7th grade, and I was very inspired to start to go out for cross country. And I started to run. I still run to this day. So for years, I've had a strong interest in endurance athletics. And a third influence came from within, and essentially was always trying to kind of find out where my outer reaches of my potential were in all aspects of my life. And so those three kind of culminated, and I started to climb, and I've always been an endurance athlete, and I just kind of went to small peaks and went higher and higher and higher.
And we're going to find out about the book that Dr. Tim has written. Lessons from Everett is the name of the book, and we'll find out about some more details of that. We're going to listen to some Mozart today, as sprinkled throughout our program, and Dr. Tim will tell you why that is and why he chose to be listening to Mozart. But one of the things that I can tell you right off the bat, meeting Dr. Tim and doing a little pre-interview, is this is not the kind of thing you just say, hey, I think I'll go out and climb Mount Everest or any mountain climbing. I know as a young guy, I was fairly outdoorsy type and Boy Scouts and Life Scout and went to, climb Mount Monadnock and so forth. That was it. And that was a long time ago. And the interesting stories that Dr. Tim is going to tell us is going to amaze most of you, I'm sure. Starting with, before we start that, just tell us about the book a little bit and why you wrote the book.
Well, why I wrote the book was because I failed to climb Mount Everest in 2007, and I invested a lot of time, effort, money in that particular trip, and became quite ill at the very end and made the good, smart decision to turn my tail around and go home and climb another day. But after that, I was hiking by myself out to catch a plane, about a three-day hike out of Mount Everest Base Camp in Nepal. And the first 24 hours, I literally never wanted to see another mountain in my life. And I totally meant it. I was done. I was through. I was beat down and beat up by the experience. Mm-hmm. I never even wanted to see a picture of a mountain for the rest of my life. And I totally meant it. Now, the second 24 hours after I spent the night on the trail, there was a little war in my head. There was the voice that was hating mountains, and then on the other shoulder there was this voice that was very patient and tenacious that kept saying, "You know what? If you do some things different, if you learn some lessons, you got a great shot to come back in 2008 and get to the top. You have a great chance." But I hate mountains. I never want to see another mountain again. So I had this war for 24 hours. The third morning when I woke up on the trail and was heading towards the small airfield where I would fly out, every fiber of my being was focused, and I knew I was coming back, and I knew I had some lessons to learn. I was nailing down the action steps during that 24 hours, and I knew I was going to come back in 2008 and give it a good go. Didn't know if I was going to make it to the top, because 1,000 things can go wrong. But I felt so calm within my soul in knowing that that was a good decision for me. And so I formulated a number of different lessons and things that I would do different in 2008, formulated seven of those, the top seven, if you will. And the thing is, nobody's going to climb Everest except for knuckleheads like myself. But everybody is going to bounce up against difficulties in their life. And that's why I wrote the book, because Everest is just a fantastic metaphor for overcoming difficulties in your life or edging a little closer to your own personal potential. Mm-hmm. That's why I wrote the book.
All right. Excellent. Well, let's listen to a little Mozart, and we'll explain when we come back from listening to this piece why we're listening to a little Mozart.
Thank you.
Dr. Tim, when you and I first talked on the phone, I mentioned to you that normally we play music on Conducting Conversations, and you said to me, well, that's not really a problem, and you brought this Mozart music along with you. When did you have the opportunity to listen to music like this?
Well, on the mountain, and it takes 2.5 months to climb Everest and make an attempt on Everest, most of that time you are flat on your back in a tent in your own head. So the iPod is very, very important on a climb like this. And because there's a lot of downtime and a lot of time staring at the tent fabric above your head, totally alone, literally and figuratively, you need to have some tools. And this is one of the tools that I learned in 2007 and changed it in 2008. You need to be relaxed, alert, but ready to go the next day. So the classical music on my iPod was designed for meditative reasons, just to calm the savage beast inside your head that might say, wow, I don't think I'm good enough to climb this mountain. What am I doing on the world's biggest mountain? People are dying on this mountain, and they might even be better climbers than me. So all these little thoughts are in your head, so you need to have tools to calm down, to meditate, and to edge close to your potential.
Excellent.
And so for me, it was definitely Mozart.
Okay, and so this music that we're going to listen to today could have been at various points along the way. And let me just say that again, 2.5 months was spent in this endeavor.
Yes, so for that, in 2007 and 2008, I spent 5 months out of 24 living on a glacier in Nepal, trying to chase my dream of getting to the top of the world.
So I had a conversation earlier in the day when I knew I was going to interview you, and said to this person that, well, I certainly would never make the climb. It might be a great view. Maybe a helicopter could just drop me up there. But it doesn't work that way, does it?
No, it doesn't work that way, especially for us Rhode Islanders.
Right. And there's a whole bunch of medical reasons, which you can explain very well as to how this all starts and why 2.5 months. Because the actual distance isn't the problem, right?
No, the distance is not the problem. I mean, it's essentially a 5.5 mile hike, albeit. Mm-hmm. Straight up, the 5.5 miles. But the adversary is the lack of oxygen. And it's not really the lack of oxygen, it's the lack of oxygen pressure. The molecules of oxygen are so far apart that we're not able to physiologically make those oxygen molecules usable to the human body. The good thing is the body is a miracle. And the more time spent at high altitude, the body creates more pathways to utilize that lack of oxygen. So creating more red blood cells in the bone marrow, changing all the chemistry of the blood, and then your body can acclimatize to that. But it's a pain fest while your body gets used to that. It takes weeks to do that. You have to progressively go up to higher levels for 2 or 3 days and then go back down to base camp and rest for a week or 6 or 7, 8 days just to get your body used to that ordeal. Mm-hmm. So it's up and down, up and down, up and down. So traditionally we would leave in late March and we would go for the summit somewhere in late May. And the reason we go for the summit in late May is because of two meteorological events. And number one would be the jet stream, which is blowing wind about 100 to 150 miles an hour. And that's on the summit for most of the year. And you cannot climb. It's physically impossible to climb with the jet stream on the summit. So that has to be blown out to sea. And what blows that out to sea is the coming high pressure of the monsoon season, which just dumps snow and would be suicidal to climb. Hmm. So you have to kind of thread the needle between those two events. And traditionally, there in late May, there's between 4 and 10 days of clear weather just before the monsoon season starts June 1st.
So good cocktail party information. If someone is in a cocktail party and says, oh yeah, I climbed Mount Everest last October, you know that now you have a little hint. They're probably not telling you the truth.
Right. I would be very suspect of that.
All right. We're going to listen to one more piece of music before we take this next break. And with all of the music today, it's Mozart, and it's relaxing, and we'll just play as much as possible and then have as much time as we possibly can with Dr. Tim finding about his adventure in climbing Mount Everest. We'll listen to this and then be back with more of Dr. Tim Warren.
Thank you. People at Robert's Musical Instruments know there are many folks out there who, like them, are passionate about music. They know because they are musicians. They teach, listen, repair instruments, and take the time to learn who their customers are. So when you step into Robert's Musical Instruments at Quaker Valley Plaza in West Warwick, you can expect to receive the very best in service and selection. Whether it be a piece of sheet music, a name brand instrument, a rental, a lesson, the right accessory, or an on-site repair, when it comes to all matters of music, you should tune into Robert's Musical Instruments.
Regarded as one of the finest living portrait artists in the United States and Europe, Dr. Michael Sulo is one of the most creative artists of the 21st century. His paintings hang in private collections all over the world and are fast becoming one of the biggest collectibles of our time. Dr. Sulo's gallery is in the Velvet Mills Complex in historic Stonington, Connecticut. There he teaches oil painting, sculpture, and fresco painting. Students taking these classes will be introduced by demonstration and hands-on experience to techniques not usually taught in American schools of art. Artists will learn the process used by the masters and explained through step-by-step demonstration. Dr. Sulo is also available for commissions, lectures, and private lessons. Visit his website at drmichaelsuloart.com or call 860-334-1264. That's 860-334-1264. Welcome back to Conducting Conversations. We're having a very pleasant evening, very unusual evening here on Conducting Conversations, in that we're talking about mountain climbing, not about orchestrations or who plays the best instrument or what kind of music you like the best. But this is an opportunity to learn something that's fascinating to me. Dr. Tim Warren is with us, and we are talking about climbing Mount Everest and lots of other places. I jokingly said in the pre-interview that, I've been to the highest peak in Rhode Island, and Dr. Tim, you mentioned you've been there too.
I just climbed it a year ago with my parents and my honey Rose and my son Kurt, and it was interesting. You park your car up on Route 101, and you have there's a sign there proclaiming that as the highest point of Rhode Island, and you walk maybe 5 minutes, and you maybe ascend all of 6 inches of height. But there's a lot of, it's funny because we met some great people out there, a bunch of other lunatics who spend their vacation time cruising around the country and trying to get to the top.
Now, there are clubs for this, right?
Yeah, yeah. The High Pointers Club is the main club. And yeah, a bunch of great individuals. Yeah.
And most states, it probably wouldn't be as easy to get to the peak as it is in Rhode Island.
But there's 4 states that you can actually drive to the top. And Rhode Island is probably, one of the easier ones beyond that.
Right.
But then there's some significantly difficult ones. And of course, the most difficult would be Mount McKinley, otherwise known as Denali, and that's in Alaska. And that's a month-long climb, of which I first attempted that in 2000 in a large guided group. We had about 12 people. But we got to the high camp where you go for the summit, and we got stuck in a 6-day storm up there, ran out of our energy, our food, and our cooking gas, and we had to descend. So it took us 4.5 months to get off the mountain, and we didn't get to the top.
4.5 months?
I'm sorry, 4.5 weeks.
Four and a half weeks. I thought you meant 4.5 days.
Four and a half weeks
to get off.
Sure, yeah.
Wow.
It was an exercise in psychological destruction as you watched your fellow people around you just dying slow deaths, waiting for the weather to clear and us to get off the mountain.
So, and that time you listened to Mozart, I guess.
Well, that was before iPod, actually. So that was a downer. We had a little FM radio that the reception was really good because we were up there, and we pulled in stations from all over the place. So that's
I'm sure
how
you were
do
listening
it.
To Classical 95.9 WCRI.
There was no web back then, no streaming. I don't.
Okay.
But then we went back in 2004, and a good friend of mine, Rob from New Hampshire, and I were able to summit Mount Denali in great form, and that's still the most beautiful mountain that I've ever been on. Love Alaska.
That's great. Great story. And getting back to Everest, a lot of us, I think of times I've seen the mountain on something like the History Channel or National Geographic, and you hear the word Sherpa and the people that live in that area. Tell us about your experience with them and what's the connection there?
The Sherpa are the indigenous people of the Khumbu Valley of Nepal, and they originally came over the mountain passes from Tibet centuries ago, inhabited this part. They're devoutly Buddhist. And they are a very, without exception, they're a happy, great, fun-loving sort of folks. And their last name is Sherpa, and their first name is traditionally the day of the week that they were born on. For example, Pemba Sherpa means he was born on a Tuesday, and he's a Sherpa. My good friend Pinjo Sherpa, spelled P-H-I-N-J-O, but pronounced Pinjo, he was born Pemba, but he became a monk until the age of four, and the Rinpoche, or the Buddhist reverend, gave him a different name. And so he keeps that name.
So, and these people are used to the altitude already.
Yeah, they've been born at 13,000 feet and lived their entire life up there. And so they're very well acclimatized, and their bodies have adapted more so than we, you know, underlings in Rhode Island have, for example.
Okay, well, we'll take a little musical interlude here, and then we're going to find out. I want to find out more about the Sherpa and how many people are involved in climbing. We'll do that right after this. On the subject of the Sherpa people, if that's the correct way of phrasing that, I think that's probably right.
Sure.
And my impression has always been, when you see the movies and you see the specials that go on, that there's this vast number of people in the team, if you will, that is going to climb the mountain. And you enlightened me a little bit and said it's not necessarily the way it works on Everest. So start us from like the base camp, and then what happens?
First of all, we take a full 12 days to even get to base camp. And the way we climb it is that we hire an outside group. I go with a group called International Mountain Guides out of Seattle. We're individual climbers, but we use IMG to kind of do all the logistics, the background, get oxygen bottles over there. And again, it's a third world, so it's you're going to have to grease the right palms and things like that.
Sure. Yeah. They got to know what they're doing.
Exactly. But all that stuff gets in, and IMG takes care of. We pool our money, and we can get a cook and a couple of cooks, and you know, have a base camp that's established and tents and things like that. And of course, our Sherpa friends are there. So that we had a team, one of the largest groups on the mountain, and we have about 20 Westerners in our group and about 20 Sherpas that we're climbing with too. Mm-hmm. And so then once you take the full 12 days, so you can acclimatize and get used to the lack of oxygen at base camp, which is 17,500 feet, then you gradually, after a Buddhist ceremony called a puja ceremony, P-U-J-A, which the Sherpas wouldn't dream of putting one foot into the climb without having the puja ceremony. And it's pretty fun. It starts out very solemn, and you know, an elderly wizened lama doing this 2-hour ceremony, and then at the end it turns into a riotous fraternity party, and it's just great. And at the very end, the penultimate moment is when a cedar pole is stuck in this cube of stone that's constructed for the occasion. Prayer flags are extended to all to 7 different directions, which is all symbolism in Buddhism. And we all take a handful of barley powder and we grind it into each other's face. And that's to signify when we're old and gray, we're still going to have our friendship, we're still going to have a love of the mountains, and we're still going to always remember the good times we had.
Wow.
So pretty cool.
So then you leave from the base camp and you start to trek, and that's when the team kind of dissolves a little bit.
Yeah, people are on different schedules, and it's safer to be, you don't rope up, you know, like you do on other technical mountains.
So when you see a movie or something like Eiger Sanction comes to mind, where these guys are roped together and...
The Eiger, you would climb with rope, so that's kind of... But on Everest, you just don't, because it's so steep and so crazy that people, you have a higher chance of dying if you are roped up. And as a matter of fact, when I was there in 2007, you know, I was down at base camp, but some friends of mine were up at about 21,000 feet, and a one person tripped. They were all roped up. There was 4 on the rope team, and they just tumbled for. They were probably dead in the first 100 meters of falling, but they just fell for thousands of feet. They just had to tear their eyes away and stop watching. It was terrible.
Yeah.
And it was just mistakes.
So it's best to just be you and...
Finjo, my Sherpa friend, and then there's other people that might be on the same schedule. So you might be climbing with some other people, not tethered with rope on this one. And so you go up partway, maybe 1,500 feet the first time, and you go back down to base camp, and you have to rest 2 or 3 days just from that ordeal. And then you would go up higher, maybe to Camp 1, which we establish about 20,000 feet. And that's through a very, very dangerous part of Everest called the Khumbu Icefall, which is all this is glaciated. So this is where the glacier, hundreds of feet underground, comes over the rocks, smashes to bits, moves 4 feet a day down the mountain, avalanches 24 hours a day, and over 40 people have died just in that section from base camp to Camp 1 since the mountain was first climbed in 1953 by Tenzing Norgay and Sir Edmund Hillary.
Wow.
So, you know, if you want, you've got to wrap yourself around the fact that you've got to go through that very dangerous part 10 times if you expect to climb Everest. And over the both years, I went through 20 times. Wow. So it's just Russian roulette.
Yeah.
And oddly, I had no fear during that. And I don't say that in a way to brag. I just kind of outside of myself looking in, I don't know why I wasn't afraid, but you know, you were there to do a job and you accepted those risks and you just go on. And many people think that is totally ridiculous too. And
well,
I get that.
I'm sure the first question a lot of people ask you is why. I'm not going to ask you that question because I think it's obvious.
Thank you for not asking, because I wouldn't even know what to say to this day.
Right. All right. We're going to listen to a little more Mozart, as Dr. Tim did when he was on the mountain. Take a short break and be back with more of Dr. Tim Warren.
Thank you.
people at Roberts Musical Instruments know there are many folks out there who, like them, are passionate about music. They know because they are musicians. They teach, listen, repair instruments, and take the time to learn who their customers are. So when you step into Roberts Musical Instruments at Quaker Valley Plaza in West Warwick, you can expect to receive the very best in service and selection. Whether it be a piece of sheet music, a name brand instrument, a rental, a lesson, the right accessory, or an on-site repair, when it comes to all matters of music, you should tune into Roberts Musical Instruments.
Regarded as one of the finest living portrait artists in the United States and Europe, Dr. Michael Suo is one of the most creative artists of the 21st century. His paintings hang in private collections all over the world and are fast becoming one of the biggest collectibles of our time. Dr. Suo's gallery is in the Velvet Mills Complex in historic Stonington, Connecticut. There he teaches oil painting, sculpture, and fresco painting. Students taking these classes will be introduced by demonstration and hands-on experience to techniques not usually taught in American schools of art. Artists will learn the process used by the masters and explained through step-by-step demonstration. Dr. Suo is also available for commissions, lectures, and private lessons. Visit his website at drmichaelsuoart.com or call 860-334-1264. That's 860-334-1264. We are back on Conducting Conversations. I'm Mike Mano, talking with Dr. Tim Warren, who has climbed Mount Everest, the first Rhode Islander to achieve that tremendous goal. And we found out a lot about the time it takes and so forth. But the other thing that he's here to talk about is the fact that he has a book out called Lessons from Everest. Let's just take a minute away from the logistics of mountain climbing and talk about the book. Tell us, again, you were inspired to write this because of the climb, right?
Right. But it goes into a little bit about my background in it and how I overcame fear, number one. Like I said before, I come from a very inauspicious climbing background. Tremendous fear of heights, but I hated having that fear. Mm-hmm. And so in the introduction, I talk about a very fearful event that I had that was a very inauspicious beginning to climbing. And then I kind of compare and contrast failing in 2007. And I love to fail because, wow, there's so much you can learn from failure. You know, when everything goes great and you succeed and everything's fantastic, you hardly even remember that. Mm-hmm. But you really remember the times when things just don't go so well.
I have a few of those.
I'm telling you. Well, congratulations on that. So the first chapter is about mission, really. Is what's your Everest? What is Everest? And Everest for me is just a big metaphor. You know, certainly, you know, I was lucky enough to be able to get up to the top and down with all my fingers and toes and a pulse. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's given me a great gift. I mean, and I knew I wouldn't really enjoy it at the time. It's a very painful endeavor, but I know I'm going to enjoy it for the rest of my life. And so that was the basis of inspiring me to write the book. Chapter two is about, you know what, it's great to have a mission and it's great if you're on the right target, but you got to do a lot of hard work there. So the hard work is necessary. Chapter three is about enjoying that journey, you know, all parts of it, not just, you know, the summit, but, you know, the training and the what you learn and what you become as you are chasing a dream or chasing or, you know, chasing a difficulty in your life to achieve. And then four, I tell a little story about how I was awakened to the huge importance in our lives of having a shred of hope that things will be better, that things will work out. And I tell a little story about that. And then as I started the 7-day summit routine cycle, the last cycle up the mountain, I was so overwhelmed by a feeling of thankfulness for the people that had helped me, my family, who maybe didn't really understand why I was doing what I was doing, but supported me nonetheless. And that was such a glorious feeling of thankfulness. And mm-hmm. I call that chapter, Thank Your Way to the Top. And then my favorite chapter, personally from writing it, is chapter six, which is from the summit on the way down, because I had huge challenges. I was starting to get brain swelling, which is a very common malady, and it can kill people in Himalayan climbing right where they stand. Wow. They could be dead before they hit the ground. And so I was very aware of the physiology of that going on and what to watch out for. And I started to exhibit that, and it was a real battle for me getting down. So it was my favorite chapter to write, as well as to reread, and I reread it a few times myself. So, mm-hmm. So that's basically those are six lessons. The seventh lesson is, hey, you got to find another Everest, you know, because you got to constantly have things that really get your blood boiling throughout your life. And for me, the next Everest was writing the book. And right now, it's it's still in mountaineering. I hope to finish the rest of the 7 summits of the world, the highest mountain in each continent. I've done 4, and I have 3 remaining. And so, but I feel no pressure to get that done.
Right,
no, because I've done the hard ones.
Right.
I'm in really good shape. I'm blessed with good health. I take care of myself. I eat well and everything like that. And one thing for the last 25 years, which has been a great sense of strength and purpose in my life, has been my practice of chiropractic. I love going into work every day and taking care of people and inspiring people to have not only a healthy but an adventurous life.
That's amazing. Amazing story. And I look at the amount of time we have left here, and I think I'm going to make a little programming change. Rather than going to another piece of Mozart, let's just finish off the conversation. We'll close out with a piece that you listened to while you were on the mountain, but let's just keep talking here to try to finish this up. And tell people, if they want more information, you do have a website that's available, right?
Yes, that's lessonsfromeverest.com.
lessonsfromeverest.com. Okay. And the book is available?
Yeah, the book's available on Amazon. It's on Kindle. It's available to order from any bookstore. It's available everywhere.
Published when?
Published by CreateSpace, and it was released in December of 2010.
Okay, so it's just about 6 months old,
right.
7 months old, and
right.
That's great. How long did it actually take you to write the book?
It took me 2.5 years. The editing was a real struggle. I mean, it was my first foray into it. I hadn't written anything since probably sophomore year of college in a creating writing class. So it was great. So I had to have some editors help me with the, this doesn't make any sense, this paragraph. You need to switch it around.
But you actually did the writing.
I wrote the whole thing.
Telling it to someone.
Yeah, exactly.
You wrote the whole thing. So that's another Everest. That's
right.
an amazing accomplishment. Not too many people are going to write a successful book. Not too many people are going to have the opportunity to climb the summits that you've had. So that is amazing, to say the least. Dr. Tim, I want to thank you for being here today. I had no idea what was going to happen when we set this up. And I'm extremely interested in all your endeavors, and I encourage people to get the book and to go to the website and check it out. Very interesting man that Rhode Islanders can be proud of, the first Rhode Islander to climb Mount Everest.
Which has brought me from the D list to the C list of Rhode Island celebrities.
There you go. And occasionally you'll find him lecturing around the state, around the area, around the country. And so check his website out. I'm sure that wherever you're going to be is on there. And that'll be great. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
It's been great, and I've learned quite a bit, and hopefully you'll look forward to learning more as I proceed on my 7 steps. Take care. See you next week, everyone, on Conducting Conversations.
Conducting Conversations was brought to you by Roberts Musical Instruments, using music and the arts to keep your child educated, entertained, and having fun. Roberts Musical Instruments is your key to musical success. Call 823-5459. That's 823-5459. And by Dr. Michael Zullo Art, regarded as one of the finest living portrait artists in the United States. Visit his gallery at the historic Velvet Mills Complex in Stonington, Connecticut. Call 860-334-1264. That's 860-334-1264.